There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. Desiree is on assignment. This is podcast number 800, August 12th. 2019, Nasser.
Thank you, sir. Congratulations from the bottom of my homey heart on this fantastic achievement. It is indeed a matter of great pride that F1 Weekly has outlasted the official Renault F1 podcast. Now back to Mr. Rogers, the 800-pound gorilla of interweb.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, new number two for Max at Red Bull. McLaren commits to a full IndyCar season in 2020, and Jimmy Johnson fails to make the postseason first time since 2004. And we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you'll want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you. Hope all is well on the left coast.
Everything is wonderful right here. We're in full celebration mode, girls climbing out of cakes. You know how the palatial studios can be when we decide to celebrate a momentous occasion.
Exactly. And, you know, I was at work and on my break, I check, you know, the web, and there is this, you know, the machete is swinging. And my first thought was, well, Dr. Marco, what took you so long? And then this news that McLaren is coming full-time to IndyCar racing. So there's a lot of chatter who will be the drivers, and thanks so much for updating on Jimmy Johnson.
I couldn't help it, but, you know, he's my kind of guy. Anyway, keep up the good work. I want to thank everybody who's made 800 possible. Of course, our webmaster, Toby Dawes, our former producer, David Tapia, our former correspondent, Desiree, who's permanently on assignment, and Steve, Yahoo Ads, Fall. Thanks, everybody, for making this a possibility. We're here, 800 NAS. The 800-pound gorilla is in the room.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And I would also like to thank all our listeners. It has been a great pleasure over the years, and we have certainly met some great listeners all across North America, South America, Europa, and hopefully soon in other parts of the world also. And greatly appreciate all the others who have remained very important members of the F1 Weekly familia. I don't know if our listeners have gone PC, but I've noticed a great decline in slings and arrows, digital slings and arrows. Maybe we have cleaned our act. I don't know. But everybody is welcome, and we are very thankful to all of them. My very special thanks to Mr. Brazier. His F1 Weekly support vehicle was instrumental in doing some of our major interviews with racing legends like John Surtees, who sadly passed away not too long ago, Tony Brooks, Jackie Oliver, and many more. Also, many thanks to the F1 Weekly support vehicle number 2 in Europe, very ably commanded by Dr. Mark Farrington, and our support vehicle number 3, piloted by Dr. Miguel, took me to the track where Ayrton Senna scored his first Grand Prix win. The two doctors and moi had a great time at Goodwood Festival last year. And many thanks to another of our listeners, Mr. Adrian, for his time at the festival. So, you know, it's been a great experience in dealing with meeting listeners, taking a lap in a Porsche at the 14.2-mile-long Nürburgring was quite a Dutch treat, courtesy of Mr. Louis Janssen, who also recently sent us a report from Hungaroring, and going to the Jose Carlos Pache circuit at Interlagos with our amigo in Sao Paulo, Senor Bartella and Miss Haisa from Minas Gerais was also a great moment. Another of the great, trips I made was south of the border, and Senor Eduardo was kind enough to give me a tour of the Mexican Grand Prix circuit, a track that I like very, very much. And sitting there in the stadium with him and chatting motor racing was very, very special. And, you know, talking of our Toby webmaster, Mr. Toby Dawes, we took a trip last winter to the Circuit Gilles Villeneuve and drove a lap each in a rental Nissan Altima. And that was fantastic. And we made some noises also, racing kind, of course. And that's what I call serious racing chills.
Keep up the good work, Nas. So it's the off season, and what I decided to do was get me my old VHS cassette player out, and I was watching Suzuka 2003 qualifying.
What was going there at Suzuka in 2003?
Well, we had Furman, we had Sato, we had Montoya. So exciting, Heinz Harald Frentzen. We had Nick Heidfeld, and it was great. Everybody was, you know, people forget, in 2003, we had a practice for qualifying. Then the following day, we had a qualifying.
And, you know, the cars looked like racing cars, and they sure sounded like racing cars. And I've been watching a lot of YouTube last several months now. And actually, I don't even watch anything on TV now because, you know, with the laptop, it's, you know, you can move around. And last night, Mr. Rogers, I spent a few hours watching the 1973 Monte Carlo Rally, an event that was, that was of more interest to me before I really got into Formula One. So, and your Renault was there, Alpine 110, I believe it is, the model. And of course, the Lancias and Fiats, just a fantastic. YouTube is fantastic stuff, man, I'll tell you. But Mr. Rogers, I have to say, be careful what you wish for just might come true. And I was thinking, what better way to celebrate the 800 podcast than I look at certain options, what can we do? Then I said, you know, hey, how about looking at race number 800? And as luck would have it for you, it was won by Nando in a Renault. But wait, there's more, much, much more. Shall we go down memory lane and chat a little bit about this historical event in Marina Bay?
Oh, the memories.
Express written consent. Which I just got your text. Thank you very much. So let's take a look at the inaugural Singapore Grand Prix in 2008. It was Formula One's first race after sunset. Little did we know the sun would go down very hard for some senior members of the team many months later. Doom, doom, doom. And which team? We all know that. This was round 15 of 18 that season. Nando was without a podium appearance so far in the season. He set the fastest time in the second and third free practice sessions, but was left 15th on the grid after a technical issue. So far, everything looked normal, and this meant no way for a win at Marina Bay. Or so we all thought, except for three wise men, father, son, and what turned out to be unholy ghost. Thus was born the Crash Gate, featuring Flavio Briatore, Pat Simmons, and Nelson Piquet Jr. This was in the days of refueling. Common practice back then was, if you are not in the top 10 on the grid, you fill it up to go long distance and then later do a quick splash and dash. I was watching the race live on telly in Cali with a couple of my F1 buddies, and we were all very surprised when Alonso came into the pits after only 12 of 61 laps. But so far everything looked normal. They say 13 is a very unlucky number, not for Nando, the machismo, el machismo. It was on this lap that his teammate Piquet Jr. crashed heavily in turn 17, where, lo and behold, there were no cranes to remove the car quickly from the track. So the safety car came out, which led to all the drivers coming into the pits. And guess who was leading the race now? The one and only Fernando Alonso. And that's where he stayed when the checkered flag came. Many, including driver in the race Nick Heidfeld, and I watched this video a few days ago, felt this was way too convenient, but a man is innocent until proven guilty in the court of law administered by none other than Max Mosley. And he sure knows how to whip a good case. Fast forward to round 10 of the 2009 Grand Prix season. After the Hungarian Grand Prix, Nelson Piquet Jr. had not scored a single point, and he got the pink slip. But Flavio made perhaps the biggest mistake of his life. Instead of giving Nelsinho a CD of Hungarian dances as a parting gift, he gave him F1 Weekly's signature tune, Shaft.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
Flavio did not know that cat was a bad mother. Nelsinho is a complicated man. No one understands him but his papa. And together they went to Max. Soon Kaka was flying in every direction. Nelsinho signing a legal document stating he was instructed to crash at the 2008 Singapore Grand Prix. Renault F1 accusing Piquet for blackmailing, a decision they would come to regret later on, with a heavy financial settlement to the Piquet familia. And it got down and dirty with Flavio leaking information on Nelson's private life, which I will not get into at this stage. After the FIA requested telemetry and radio communication data from Renault F1, the pressure was too much for Pat Simmons, and at Spa he gave his version of events. One thing was crystal clear, the crash was orchestrated by the team. What is not clear to this day is who came up with the idea of working on the night move. Nelsinho says it was Pat Simmons' idea. Pat Simmons says it was Nelsinho's idea. Whether it was loyalty or millions of liras promised by Flavio, Pat Simmons never threw him under the bus. And as happened in the Spygate, the man in the Marina Bay moonlight came out winning, smiling, and totally innocent. How lucky can you get in back-to-back controversial seasons? On September 16, 2009, Renault announced Flavio and Pat have left the Enstone building. Now, this is just a personal opinion on this situation after the facts. I think the real victim of this was Nelsinho's fellow Brazilian Felipe Massa. He was leading the race from pole position when the safety car came out, and then he had that fuel rig problem when leaving the pits. It probably cost him the world championship. According to Massa, some months after the 2008 Singapore Grand Prix, he and Nelsinho were driving to a karting event in Italy, and he joked with Nelsinho if he had crashed on purpose. Nelsinho assured him he would never do that. And that was race number 800 in the otherwise glorious history of Formula One Grand Prix motor racing.
Bravissimo, bravissimo, bravissimo. I think that's all fake news, Naz. You know that.
And so is the whole 2007 season.
What? I don't remember that season.
I know. So, what do you have to say about Gasly? Were you surprised? Shocked?
Not real. I mean, come on. We knew this was happening, and I think they really... I mean, when we saw Christian Horner crying like a whimpering woman about how Albon's fighting with Super Aguri in the midfield, and Max is fighting with Ferrari, obviously there's a problem.
Yeah, you know, on ESPN F1 website, they had done some, data analysis between Max and Gasly. It is pretty sad. You know, they said that had Max started the season, missed all the races and started the season from the Austrian Grand Prix, he would still have a lot more points than Gasly. And to win a race and lap your teammate, that pretty much did it for Dr. Marco and Christian Horner.
Yeah, I think Gasly's lucky he still has a ride.
Oh, yeah, very lucky. I mean, it's so hard to get to Formula One. But, now I'm feeling bad for Alexander Albon. I mean, he's not going to beat Max Verstappen. I mean, you and I both know that.
No, but if he's...
if he stays close to Max, he'll be fine.
You know, I mean, if Max finishes second and he finishes fourth, that I think will be acceptable. And I think he needs to be no more than 0.3 seconds slower, not half a second like Gasly.
But let's not forget, Albon has looked very, very good this season and has done very, very well. And we could be surprised when he gets behind that Red Bull.
Yes. And you're right. He has done a very good job. And especially he has a very, you know, experienced and a pretty quick race car driver as his teammate. But one thing I knew, I just knew that they're not going to promote Kvyat.
No, and I think Kvyat knew that even though he was on the podium. Yeah, that's a tough call for him.
Yeah. So let's see. I hope now what remains to be seen, I mean, if Gasly cannot even beat Kvyat, then, you know, it will be chop-chop from the whole Red Bull program.
Oh, absolutely. He has to beat Kvyat. The torpedo must be taken down.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see how that works out. Now, you're excited about McLaren coming to IndyCars full-time?
Not really. I mean, after what happened at Indianapolis, the last thing it depends. I mean, who their driver lineup is. I mean, I don't know. I think the whole thing is a little bizarre, to be honest with you.
Well, this time they're going with the established player, Schmidt-Peterson Racing.
Right, but I still think that it's a long shot.
And, you know, just to confirm that Honda will not supply Alonso engine. Right now that team is running Honda engines. And most likely, I think Alonso will show up with this team at Indy. So they have asked Honda to release them from the contract starting next season.
So that means Chevrolet?
Yes. See the USA in your Chevrolet.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, sorry, Bob. Especially if they can power Alonso to a Indy 500 win, that'll be fantastic.
Especially for Chevrolet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, I'm really surprised that Chip Ganassi or even Roger Penske did not try to get Nando in their teams.
Are you surprised, Ness?
Yeah, I am, because, you know, Roger Penske and Chip Ganassi, they love a winner. But they may have had some, you know, talk with Ron Dennis or Christian Horner or some other players, you know, they may have said, you know, watch out.
You mean the hot potato syndrome?
Yes. Yes. The man is from Oviedo, but he was raised in Idaho. Oh, my God. Okay, what else is happening in this world for you?
Oh, nothing. Of course, you know, Jimmy Johnson not making the cut in the postseason. I'm sure you were distraught.
Man, I used to enjoy NASCAR racing or any motorsports for that matter. But, you know, once they introduced that stage thing, that just, then I lost interest. I haven't watched a race, NASCAR race, in quite a few years now. But I do follow the, you know, the results and all that. And so we'll see. Okay, sir, good news from, or should I say, bueno news. The Mexican Grand Prix contract has been renewed for another 3 years. And nice to have a race in a destination city where there is also passion for motorsports. And Chase Carey is on the chase is on for Chase Carey. He is determined to bring a race in Miami, but he did say they ran into some serious opposition from the locals. And my guess is the area they want to use, 90% of the population is probably, have been members of AARP for at least a couple of decades. So I don't think they're going to be interested in noise and all the disruption that Formula One race will bring. But it will be fantastic if they can do a race in Miami area. California would be even, I cannot say it will be even better, but it will be equally good if they can do a race in SoCal, especially Long Beach, man. That'll be fantastic.
That would be fantastic.
Now, Bottas has plan A, B, and C. Now, this is the main talking point of F1 summer break. So the question is, who will be the shining star at Mercedes next to LCH in 2020? Not a clear vision at this time, but I think Mercedes or Toto, they have three options. You know that Toto is part owner of the Mercedes F1 team?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah, sure. When he was brought in, they gave him a stake, and Lauda had some stake also. So I will not be surprised if Mercedes officially pulls out, that they sell the team or hand over to Toto Wolff. Now, the options I think they have three are these. First is to keep Bottas. He is a certified number two like DC and Rubinho, good enough for a few wins every year and a solid point scorer. And most important, to borrow a phrase from Christian Horner, and hate to say this again, Mr. Rogers, he is not toxic and not creating chaos in a team. I wonder who could that be at the pinnacle of our sport. And the wind cries, Nando! Advantage with Bottas is Lewis will be trouble-free most of the time at the front of the grid. Most likely this will give him opportunity to equal Michael Schumacher's number of championship wins and even more likely surpass his number of Grand Prix wins at the end of the 2020 Formula One season. This remarkable and unbelievable achievement will go down in history as a Mercedes driver. Long-term PR benefits of this amazing feat, if it works out this way, and of course there's no guarantee of these things. Second option is what they're looking at, Esteban Ocon. Very impressive junior Formula credentials, and the rise to the top echoes the journey taken by Lewis and Anthony Hamilton. Ocon may be dreaming of butterflies, zebras, and fairy tales at Mercedes next year, and I wish him all the best, as I do for all of the drivers. But he may find out, like another young French driver this season, that going against machismo of motorsports is a little different than battling Sergio Perez. I am sure in the best package, Ocon is a race winner, but only time will tell if he can rattle the cage of soon-to-be six-time world champion. The third option is what we racing fans all want to see in 2020, Max at Mercedes. Unfortunately, this may not happen in our lifetime. How wonderful it is to have two tigers in one cage. All any team manager has to do is a quick review of the 1988 and 2007 season. Who would you like to see next year at Mercedes next to LCH Senior?
Oh, I think Ocon is fine. I mean, Max is, he's stuck at Red Bull. And I think Max is happy at Red Bull. Max is not a stupid man. Does Max want Max against them? You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I have an idea what you're saying, sir.
So why don't we take a quick break and come back with MM, and we have an interesting interview. So we'll be back after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Fisichella, and you are listening F1 Weekly.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you the F1Weekly.com web surfer with ads that interest you. From mobile shift knobs to rental cars in Indianapolis, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you wanna.
Thank you, Steve. Keep up the good work.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the King, the Swami, the Karachi Kid himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir, and we shall start with what a thrilling event this was, MotoGP from Red Bull Ring in Austria. What a doozy we had on the final lap. And folks, if you have not seen this, please check it out on YouTube or whichever way you want to do it. Marc Marquez on a Honda leads the race. Andrea Dovizioso had traded places with him with two corners to go on the final lap. It was looking for the Honda man to take another win this season. He is having a season that Lewis Hamilton is having. Then on the final corner, Dovi dive-bombed Marquez and gave him a taste of his own medicine, straight off Walgreens' shelf. Great victory for Dovi and Ducati. Your homeboy, French rider Fabio Quartararo, was third after leading the race in the early stages. And this was really, really fantastic motorsports. Did you see any of this, sir?
Yes, sir. Pretty exciting. I started to cry a little bit.
Yeah, no, it was very impressive. And especially, you know, when the underdog wins, it's a great moment for motorsports. So I really, really enjoyed it. And normally, you know, what happens is I know the result, but this time I did not know when I was watching this replay on YouTube or whatever it was. So I really, it was fantastic. Now, sir, this is very interesting. There is also, talking about destination cities, a Grand Prix in Saudi Arabia. Talking of destination cities, There are plans and discussions to hold an F1 race in the oil-rich kingdom. Dakar Rally is already moving there from South America. Did you know that, sir?
No, I did not.
Yeah, can you believe that?
I believe anything.
Yeah. Destination cities mean that the final destination has a big barrel of dollars. But I just have a travel advisory. If you plan to attend the Grand Prix or Dakar Rally in Saudi Arabia, try not to apply for a tourist visa at the Saudi Arabian embassy in Istanbul. And that was Zinger of the Day. Okay, now we come to a championship, a new champion, a lady we interviewed not too long ago, the Formula W Series. And you know, Formula W Series, I would expect them, a new series, to have all the races on YouTube, like Japanese Formula 3, DTM, and a lot of events are on, you know, Formula 3. They are put on YouTube. No, I don't think Formula 3, not with the new one. The old one used to be. But for Formula W was not on YouTube, but I found out at the last minute, I think a couple of hours before, that the season finale will be on live, so I watched it. Lady who won the very first Formula W race in history, Jamie Chadwick, is also its first ever champion. The season finale took place on Sunday at Brands Hatch. The English lady started from pole but slipped down to fourth after being passed by her only championship challenger, Bijke Visser from Netherlands. At the front it was close. Another English lady, Alice Powell, was able to hold back Finn Emma Kimilainen to score her first win in the series. Sabre Cook, I believe that's the name, Sabre Cook from Colorado, was the highest placed American racer. Scoring 12 points, she finished 12th in the championship, which is very good, as the top 12 drivers in the championship will be invited again to race in the 2020 season. So that will be good, and I really enjoyed this race, and it was a pretty clean race and a competitive race. It was a good battle at the front and some mid-pack close fighting. Overall, very good, very impressive, and I wish all these ladies drivers all the best. And Miss Chadwick is already has some sort of affiliation with Claire Williams and also with the Aston Martin racing team. And Bijke Visser, you know, some years ago, I was following her career because she was doing very well when she was in karting. She used to be part of the Red Bull program, but if Pierre Gasly cannot keep Dr. Marco happy, it will be very hard for Bijke to make him happy. You know what I'm saying, Rogers?
Yeah, I do.
So who won the stock car race?
I'm not even sure, Ness.
Oh, you're slacking now on your favorite series?
It was Greg Biffle.
Greg Biffle, that's good. Okay, sir, now, since this is the off-season, so we can use some motorsports history and information. So this is a segment we call The Long Wait, a moment in motorsport history. In this segment, we will look at the long wait race fans from different nations have endured for race victory and championship glory. We will start with the nation that won the very first Formula One championship race and the title, and that, of course, would be Italia, courtesy of Nino Farina. In fact, three of the first four World Drivers' Championships were won by Italian drivers, Alberto Ascari winning back-to-back championships in 52 and 53. Hard to believe Italy has not produced a world champion since 1953. The last time Italian Grand Prix was won by an Italian driver was 1966. And the winning Ferrari then was driven by Ludovico Scarfiotti. The last Italian Grand Prix winner was our favorite, Fisico, way back in 2006 in Malaysia. Currently, we only have one Italian driver in Grand Prix racing, Signor Antonio Giovinazzi with Alfa Romeo. So unfortunately, I think it will be quite a few seasons still before we see an Italian Grand Prix winner and champion. And talking of Giovinazzi, do you think he's on the same slippery slope as Gasly?
Indeed he is.
Yeah, you know, he cannot even beat old man Kimi Raikkonen, and that's not very good. Next, we go to Argentina, the nation that produced the second Formula One world champion and one of the all-time greats, the maestro Juan Manuel Fangio. He was in his early 40s when he won his first world championship in 1951 with Alfa Romeo. His fifth and final championship came with Maserati in 1957. And since then, the land of Pampas, Peron, and Gato Barbieri has been looking for the next world champion. Lole, also known as Carlos Reutemann, remains the last Argentine driver to win a Grand Prix, and that was in 1981 at Zolder, Belgium. Now, something of interest to you, sir. From the Pampas, we go to Paris to investigate the French connection. Renault and Michelin, a match made in motorsports heaven, won the very first Grand Prix in 1906. In over 60 years of Formula One championship history, Le Professeur is the only French world champion, and very impressively on four different occasions, and remains the only Formula One champion to have driven a Ferrari truck. I have never even seen one. Jean Alesi came into Formula One with a lot of new motivation and emotions, but his birthday present to himself in Canada in 1995 is all he has in terms of winning in Formula One. His fellow Francais, Olivier Panis, himself a one-hit wonder, remains the last French driver to win a Grand Prix, and that was in Monte Carlo in 1996. Now we come to United States. American involvement and influence in Formula One is far more extensive and lengthy than most people realize. Even though the first United States Grand Prix did not take place till 1959 at Sebring, Florida, the greatest spectacle in racing, also known as the Indy 500, used to be part of World Championship throughout the first decade of Formula One. There was an American Formula One World Champion, Phil Hill, in 1961 with Ferrari, long before there was World Champion from Germany, France, or Brazil. Slick tires came into Formula One courtesy of a company based in Akron, Ohio, Firestone Tire and Rubber, thanks to their experience in drag racing scene. A dude from Southern California gave Honda their first Grand Prix win in the sunshine of Mexico City. That was Richie Ginther in 1965, which was also the first Grand Prix win for another company from Akron, Ohio, Goodyear Tire and Rubber. Technology and telemetry is all over Formula One now. One of the earliest users of telemetry was a guy named Carl Kempf, American guy, for Tyrrell Team. The almighty dollar has been behind some major F1 projects like Ford Motor Company financing Cosworth DFE, Marlboro paying salaries for drivers with names like Niki Lauda, Alain Prost, Ayrton Senna, Michael Schumacher, Fernando Alonso, and Sebastian Vettel. Mario Andretti was the last American to win an F1 race and the championship, and his final win came at the Dutch Grand Prix in 1978. Now we move to Sweden. While neighboring Finlandia has produced three world champions and two solid number twos, the home of IKEA has not been able to assemble a championship-winning driver as yet. In fact, only two Swedish drivers have won Formula One races. Joe Bonnier was the first with BRM in 1958, and much missed Ronnie Peterson was the last Super Swede to win a Grand Prix, and that was in 1978. Austria. And from Austria we go to Australia. Land Down Under has made it to the top of the podium in Formula One in every decade since 1950 except for the 1990s. Jack Brabham started winning races and championships in late 1950s. He won his third and final championship in 1966 and his final Grand Prix in 1970. Alan Jones was world champion in 1980 with Williams, and this century race winners have been Mark Webber, who almost won the championship in 2010, had it not been for the Sebastian Vettel love fest at Red Bull, and of course the other Aussie winner is Daniel Ricciardo. And sir, anything else you would like to add?
It's vacation time, and of course it's Monterey week. So I'll be heading down to Monterey in the middle of the week, checking out what's going on. Mecum, Gooding and Company, Pebble Beach, and of course Laguna Seca, where we shall meet.
Yes, I'm flying out on Thursday. I get into San Jose International Airport around 11 o'clock. So I will see you on Friday. I know you sent an email to our friend, Senor Gentile. Has he responded? Is he coming?
He says, yeah, let's put something together, but... you know, he's a moving target. He's very hard to pinpoint.
So now we come to famous last words. Kubica on the performance difference between the two Williams drivers. This is what he says, and I quote, "For now, it's as if we are eating two different dishes. One comes from a good restaurant, and the other is prepared by myself, and I'm not a very good cook." End of quote. All I have to say is, I feel the pierogi pity for Kubi.
Well, it's Williams, so it doesn't really matter, does it?
That is very true. And talking of Kubica, do you think we will see him next year?
No, I think this will wrap it up. He'll know he doesn't belong, and we'll see him reporting on the sidelines for Polish television.
Well, that's not a bad gig.
That's a great gig. Are you kidding?
Yeah, go to all the Formula One races. That must be nice.
Yeah, and free in-flight burrito.
Absolutely.
There you have it, Ness. You want to introduce the interview, or should we just play it and hide?
Okay, David, first of all, thank you for your time. Before we talk about your long and successful career, can you give us an update on the racing life of Dayton Coulthard?
Well, he's doing some practice in karting, but he hasn't done any racing as yet. But, you know, I was not really looking to get a kart for our son, but he turned around and said he wanted to go karting, and so I guess like... any parents, you want to try and give them the opportunity, and well, he tells me he's going to be a Grand Prix driver, but I'm not so sure. But anyway, we'll see how it develops.
Okay, your dad was Scottish karting champion. How old were you when you realized you were quick enough to go all the way?
Well, I got a kart when I was 11 and started racing locally, and then you know, realized that we were winning in Scotland. So then, of course, you start going to England, and then you know, kind of develops from there. So I never really considered I would make a professional career until I started in cars when I was 17, and I won both the championships that year, and realized that there was a potential income stream. So I stopped my college course where I was studying business computing and went full time in racing, and you know, here we are now.
When you stopped college and school, mom and dad were fully supportive of your racing career?
My mother wasn't too impressed, but my dad was absolutely fine, of course, because he always said you can go back to your studies if it doesn't work out. So anyway, yeah, racing provided an opportunity.
In 1991, you were second to Rubinho in British Formula 3, but won the prestigious Macau Grand Prix. What were the highs and lows during the season?
You know, I think that's a championship that slipped away because, you know, the last couple of races, I think Donington I stuck in gear, and then the last race I made contact with a Japanese driver, and when I was in front of Rubens, and that would have been enough to win the championship. So I won more races that year than he did, and as you say, I won Macau and also Zandvoort. So you know, I'm still disappointed I didn't win that championship, but it was a great opportunity for me to, you know, get into testing for Williams, and that led to, you know, being a professional driver.
Talking of Macau, what is more challenging to drive at Monte Carlo or Macau?
They're both challenging for different reasons. You know, Macau, a large part of the track is just wide open. You know, the main straight and all that sort of thing. There's not a lot of skill involved there. But obviously up over the hill, it's quite tight and twisty. But it's like Monaco, it's very fluid. You know, it's there's no really awkward corners as such. So, you know, I've always enjoyed street tracks and the challenge that they present.
What is bigger sensation, Eau Rouge in a Formula One car or flat out in the middle of the night on Mulsanne Street in a Jaguar XJ220?
There's definitely through Eau Rouge gets your attention a lot more. The Le Mans experience, I'm glad I had the experience. That car was quite quick in a straight line. It wasn't particularly quick in the corners, but you know, I'm definitely more of a sprint racer than an endurance racer. I just didn't really, you know, I didn't enjoy as much being there for a whole week and racing 24 hours. You know, I'd rather get in, do the job, and get home.
Now, you were teammates to both Kimi Raikkonen and Mika Hakkinen, and once you were quoted as saying, it's hard to believe how quickly they can go without even trying. What makes them so quick?
I think they were both naturally very talented drivers, so they didn't have to really work at it. It just came easily to them. You know, I was certainly someone that had to sort of study the craft a lot more and work harder to deliver the lap time. And in the end, that's why I think they both ended up winning championships. I wouldn't say that either of them had a particularly high work ethic, but they had the skills to get the job done.
Now, between the two, who is more talkative, if that word can be used for them?
Yeah, I think that Mika is a more communicative guy than Kimi. Kimi's, he's quite introvert in many ways, isn't he? So, he doesn't say a lot.
We all make mistakes in life. Between Monza and Adelaide 1995, which one made you more unhappy? And I'm curious what Mr. Patrick Head had to say when you got back to the garage.
Well, certainly Adelaide was more costly because, I lost out on a win bonus for Williams, and it also affected the contract I had with McLaren for 96-97. So that was financially a big hit. And disappointing because the perception was that it was just a pure driver error, but the reality is the downshift blip gave more RPM on the re-engagement of the clutch, so it pushed the car on, and it was just such a tight entry, there was nothing I could do. It just looked pathetic, but when you're right on the edge and you have to be on the edge everywhere, there was no margin. The Monza one was a pure mistake on my part. I got to restart in the T car, but then that car had been used in the warm-up in Spa, and the front wheel bearing failed and seized and spun me off. So, that's racing. These things happen.
Is it true you called Ron Dennis to drive for McLaren from a phone at Williams' team?
Yeah, absolutely. We'd gone to sign a two-year deal with Williams for 95-96, and Frank changed his mind because of a negotiation he was doing with Damon. And we went into the secretary's office, phoned Ron, and agreed that we'd come down and sign a contract with them for 96-97. So things could have been different had we stuck with it. But in the end, I had a long career at McLaren, of course. Yeah.
Now, talking of McLaren, as a racing fan, lifelong racing fan, and like millions all over the world, I saw a Scottish bird fly at Manicur in 2000. Can you share your emotions and circumstances leading to that moment?
Well, I was just very frustrated that Michael had sort of cut me up off the start-finish line. And he was always, very hard racer. So I just wanted to share and vent my frustration. But I was very happy, of course, that I was able to overtake him and then go on and win that Grand Prix. So I think that was one of my better victories.
Now, you also had a brief sort of a teammate situation with Ayrton Senna. Any thoughts on him as a racer and a person?
Yeah, Ayrton was exceptional, wasn't he? He was an incredible person, had real presence. So it's still shocking to think he passed away at such a young age, but that sadly is what happened on that particular weekend in Imola. It was obviously a traumatic time for all his family, friends and fans around the world, and also for the Williams team, because there was the court case against Patrick and Adrian, and I had to go to the court and basically be part of that hearing. But anyway, in the end, there was no evidence to suggest that there was a car failure as such. It was just one of those unexplained incidents.
Your most satisfying Grand Prix win?
I think maybe Monaco or Magny-Cours or Spa, because they were all very strong victories. I never had the ultimate consistency in my driving to win a championship, but I had moments where I think I was able to race on that level.
Your ex-boss Ron Dennis has the way he has gone out from McLaren, it's pretty sad, and I say this as a racing fan. What's your take on what happened there, and how do you view it?
Business, and especially the business of sport, it's harsh, for drivers, and in many ways it shouldn't be any different for all of the other positions. You have to perform, and to perform you need support, and in the case of Ron, obviously he's lost the support of his board, and ultimately they were able to find a way to a mechanism to shut him down in terms of not having any control of the team anymore. So he's now completely out of McLaren, and and life moves on. You know, Ron will obviously be remembered as the architect of the modern success of McLaren. But you know, this business is not about celebrating the past, it's about creating the future, so things move on.
In terms of team atmosphere as a driver, what was the best experience, Williams, Red Bull or McLaren?
I enjoyed them all. You know, different phases of my life. Williams was obviously the beginning, and it represented development in my career. McLaren, that's where I grew and really, you know, understood how to the work ethic of what it took to be in a team like that. And Red Bull, I was able to use my experience to help the team grow and put in place key people to create an opportunity for success, and then the proof is in the results they've had, so I can feel good about that. I still have a relationship with Red Bull. To be honest, I still have good relations with each of the teams, so I think that it's an important part of how you have success in this business is to understand how to deal with people.
Lots of racing fans miss the scream of Matra and Ferrari V12 and the like. Are you happy with the sound we now have in hybrid era?
No, I'm not, but I don't suppose anyone is. Formula One doesn't always make the best decisions for cost and for the fans, despite what people would say was the contrary. But I hope the next set of regulations engage the fans' desires to have noisy, powerful sounding cars. You know, the cars look good in terms of speed now, but it's only just getting us back to where we were in 2004. So, you know, what we've been doing for the last, you know, 15 years or so.
A very important question now as a racing fan. If you were RD and not DC in the time frame you were in Formula One, who would have been your two drivers?
If I was running a team, who would I have? Oh, well, you know, you already have. I think that from a childhood point of view, having Prost and Senna in the same team was pretty special. But you know, you would pick any of the headline guys, you know, a Hamilton or a Senna and a Schumacher, all of those exceptional drivers. But we did a pretty good job.
One last request: can you say hi? I'm DC, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Hi, I'm David Coulthard, otherwise known as DC, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks.
Very
nice.
Gracias, muchacho. Keep up the good work, Nas. I want to thank everybody who listens all these years. We will continue, and I guess we'll make it to 1,000 somehow.
That is my goal also, Mr. Rogers. If we can make it to 1,000 podcasts, maybe 1,001, and then hand over to some other young people so who can carry on the good work of Mr. Rogers.
That's a good idea. We could call those guys Click and Clack.
There you go.
See? Okay, Nas, keep up the good work. Good night. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.